This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
I'm Leonard Oakland from the English faculty. Happy to welcome you to this Endowed English Reader event. Before I introduce our reader tonight, let me take the opportunity to say this much, that over the last of about 20 years, we have built an endowment within the English program to bring poets, novelists, and creative nonfiction writers to campus, and we've had a whole series of writers who have come as part of this endowment. And our students have contributed to this endowment, our alumni have contributed, faculty from the department have contributed. I just want you to know that you're inheritors, and I hope in the now and in the future will be participants and contributors to this endowment that every semester enriches our life at Whitworth, and particularly our life within the writing program. I'm very happy to welcome David Daniel. He is family to me, but let me tell you something about him as a poet, as well as his being my son-in-law, which is why we were so lucky to be able to bring him to campus. David grew up in Kentucky, in North Carolina, in Louisiana, in Tennessee, and now lives in Massachusetts, has lived in Massachusetts for quite a while, like 15 years, 22 years now, in Cambridge, Mass. He attended Vanderbilt University. He has an MA from Johns Hopkins, has an MFA from the University of Virginia. Perhaps more interestingly, David taught for quite some years at Emerson College in Boston, where he was, in addition to being a teacher on the faculty, working with students, he was the editor, the poetry editor of Plowshares Magazine, which is one of the most eminent literary magazines in the United States. David now teaches at Fairleigh Dickinson University in Madison, New Jersey, where he teaches literature courses, but especially where he heads the creative writing program. He teaches poetry particularly. He came to Fairleigh Dickinson University 4 years ago and found that he had 12 writing majors in the program. And by now, he has helped to build the program so that they have 75 in their program over the last 4 years. David also now, he doesn't work as poetry editor for Plowshares anymore, but he now works with the Literary Review, which is a periodical that comes out of Fairleigh Dickinson University. One of the most interesting things, I think, to talk about with David, and some of you students have talked about this in classes today, when he has met with a couple of classes, a poetry writing class and a literary editing and design class, is the festival that David has created at FDU in the last couple of years called WAMFest, or Words and Music Festival. In this WAMFest, David has begun to bring to campus well-known poets and songwriters, but now not just for a performance, especially in the case of the songwriters, singer-songwriters, but to interact with students and to talk about what it is to write the words of the songs. Where did the words come from? What do the words mean? What do the words mean to the students as listeners? Where did they perhaps begin to mean something to the man or woman who wrote them? And he has brought names like John Wesley Harding and Roseanne Cash, and now he's looking forward next month to bringing Bruce Springsteen to campus, along with poets at the same time. So it's not just bringing a big name songwriter, but a poet like Paul Muldoon, a poet and other poets who have come to campus. So this is, for me, in talking with him about the kind of things, the kind of growing programs in the arts, is to me, and I think to our faculty and our students, a really interesting model of things that are being done. And I like the way that David talks about it, how he talks about his own loves as a teenager, love for music, love for rock and roll, that seemed to get left out in college courses, in becoming a poet, in falling in love with literature. But now with this kind of emphasis represented by the Wham Fest, it's bringing together those parts and not saying this is high culture and this is low culture, this is popular culture or something, but instead saying these are the experiences that shape us. These are the things that we have often come to love outside of the university, outside of the academy. How do they fit with the experiences that are valued within the academy? Poetry has a place for 1,000 years and more. Poetry has had a place in the university, but popular culture has not had. Where do they intersect? In the curriculum and in me. In me as a listener, in me as a creator. One more word here about, some of you have seen David's book called Seven Star Bird, which is available for purchase out in the lobby, and there'll be a chance to have copies of it signed if you want after the reading and after the question and answer period that we can have at the end of the reading. This work, Seven Star Bird, is a connected collection of poems that focus on David's own forebears, his own ancestors, men and women from Czechoslovakia who moved to Texas to be farmers in a town called Friendship, Texas. But a dam submerged that town. It doesn't exist anymore. Seven Star Bird is, in a sense, a rescue effort, a project to recapture, at least in memory, this submerged community. A project that brings together family history, immigrant experience, and the mythology of the American West, as represented in Texas, at least. And in that, I think it reminds us, too, that we too have stories. We too have history. Family history that intersects with cultural history, that intersects with national and political history. We have stories that are buried. We have stories that have been denied, that have been, in a certain sense, silenced. David has, in Seven Star Bird, then taken some of this, some of these experiences, and brought them out of silence into his words. He's been writing a lot of poems since the publication of Seven Star Bird. He's going to read a couple of poems from Seven Star Bird tonight, he tells me, and some others that are newer and that we'll get to hear this evening. And he'll tell you some things about them himself. But now, please welcome David Daniel.
And the screen. Thank you. One of these days, these will be implanted, you know. Won't be long now. Phone this. Thank you, Leonard. Thank you all for having me. It's an honor to be here, and certainly a great pleasure with all the family history, and then today to create some new history by meeting so many of you, which was absolutely delightful, and I'm really was just moved by being around the students and seeing what a community you've built and how excited you seem to be together. And I'm certainly hoping that my program, as it matures, will follow this lead. But thank you. So normally, there are a couple of ways, I guess, or a few ways of doing readings. And I thought, since this is mostly about students, I'd like to have it be as interactive as you would like for it to be. And so please feel free to interrupt, heckle, whatever you like, or to ask questions along the way. That's perfectly fine. And I'll probably over-introduce the poems and risk being one of those people whose introductions are more interesting than their poems. So I'll try to make the introductions as boring as I can, but filled with information. This community that this book is sort of the center of this book, Seven Star Bird, was a place that I spent a great deal of time as a child. And it was a tiny community in Central Texas that was all Czech. And so I would go there. All the grown-ups all spoke Czech, and everything about it, the food, everything, all the stores were Czech. But they wore the cowboy hats and the pickup trucks, and it was just a strange. It just didn't make a lot of sense. In the church there were Moravian, and so I would go to the church there, and it was all in Czech with all the great hymns, and yet it was just the leather-necked great farmer types. And so when the dam came, and the dam was built to protect the richer towns that were south of Friendship, and what happened is my entire family that was there, and of course the whole community, just dispersed. It just had to move away. And what was most, this happened when I was about 12. And it was the notion of not being able to go home, especially for my mother, but to some degree for me, because we moved around so much, that was sort of a center, became, without me really knowing it, a central metaphor, I think, for my life, and that's what sort of mining throughout the book. I think one of the things that I sort of came to over this is the notion, and this came up a little bit in some of our conversations tonight, that how, in many ways, the experience of being American is quite often the experience of being an immigrant, whether you're literally one or not, but the fact that the notion of home for a lot of us is a fluid one, and the sort of the perpetual need for creating some form of identity as we sort of move through space is just crucial to this. But I'll just read maybe three poems from this collection. And the first one, really from the beginning, middle, and end. The first one has nothing to do with friendship, but it has to do with family. My now 15-year-old came home from first grade with a joke, as first graders will do. But this one was pretty good, which is really unusual. So I wrote a poem about it. So the first part of the poem is actually the joke, and then there's a little play on it. The joke. The skeleton, my son says, can't cross the road because it doesn't have the guts. It's pretty good, right? Which explains, perhaps, why it's still at the edge of our yard, looking out across the road into the dark. I'm just kidding. You see, it's us by the roadside, our bones the wind whistles, and the darkness beyond, that's ours also. Starts off funny, becomes less funny. There's a section in the middle that deals with some of the characters that were around the farm and Friendship. Being Czech was not a great thing to be in Texas, but there was one worse thing to be in Texas, and that was to be Mexican. and it was, so, it's just that sort of that wonderful way of which we always look for someone to look down upon. And for that, it was the Mexicans who worked with, in this case, a man named Mr. Swetner, who worked for my grandfather. There's a mention of chinchillas here. people raise chinchillas there for their fur. You can buy them now in pet stores and if you want. So this is imagining at the point where the town was about to be flooded, the characters as they were beginning to take off from the town. It's called Mr. Swetner's Parade. Mr. Swetner puts his cart before his snow-eyed mule and pulls them down the field roads of Friendship, Texas, dragging cans. "Wake up," he cries. "Let's get on with it." These were the words my grandfather used to rouse him and the other Mexicans who lived in the wetback shed across the cattle guard. Long ago, Mr. Swetner's son fell from a tractor and was baled with the maize. And a year later, his wife and child died in childbirth. On that night, he hammered his 65 chinchillas to death and left their skinned bodies in a pile alive with green flies. So if he's now come back to gather the dead Mexicans, and only them, we ought to forgive his insolence, because there is no guilt here, and rather follow to where he takes the dead ones, some place still not owned, but forever theirs. Everybody okay? I forgot to introduce the fact that they had to move, you know, as when this happens, they have to dig up all the graves and move the bodies from the area, from the floodplain. And that was one aspect of that. This one's going to require a lot of introduction. It's called Seven Star Bird. It's a title poem. There are a couple of references. One is to Valentine, an early Christian, sort of a mystic, but primarily known as now a Gnostic thinker. Isaac Luria was a 16th century, sort of is considered the founder of Kabbalah. Those of you who are Madonna fans may know Isaac Luria. Isaac Luria was actually mentioned in what's the TV show that was on for a long time? What's that? No, David Duchovny's initial thing, X-Files. Yeah, they had a golem that was. I knew we had a chance with a golem that was named Isaac Luria. I thought that was hilarious that there was some very sophisticated person behind the scenes writing this thing. The poem begins with an invocation, an epigraph from Ovid from the Metamorphoses, which is one of my central books, and it's the part of that's very early in the Metamorphoses. Where the gods have made various versions of beings and sort of screwed up every time and just washed them away. and the call is to let the river horses come down and flood to wipe away the mud people or the stick people, whichever version it was before the next recreation. There's also, it's important to know this is addressed to my first son, Doc. So it's sort of, it's actually being spoken to him. And I think that we'll probably do it. So here's the epigraph. And God's anger called his rivers all and told them, let the river horses run wild as they ever would. And the leaping rivers flooded the great plains. Seven Star Bird. As breezes lap the shallow tugged tide flow and swallows twitter and skirt the dusk, we lie within the wreckage of the stars. The moon spill, our planets pull, this sad machine. With you sleeping against my chest, having drifted off as Venus began to blaze, I feel my father's heavy breath bear down against my cheek, a finger toward the comet's tail, like a damn flashlight looking down, he said. For three nights we watched it, then that light was out. So we steered by the swirling mathematics of whiskey and revenge, the business of getting, then of letting go. Stars gather in the sky like rain, dizzy atoms that collapse, collide. In our dream, the dead of Friendship, Texas, stand on the shore of their once town singing. Let the river horses run. Let them run. Once in America, in full nakedness, our family rivered these lands with abandon. From Moravia to Galveston to Friendship, Texas, their wild seeds sown, their hearts full of leaving, they long to abide. Abide, reside. But the tide comes to meet us and also to take us away. When the dam was built to swell the rich town south, the flood spilled over. Let the river horses run. Valentinian speculation holds that our souls, as light, are drawn to the waxing moon, which then, upon the wane, delivers its freight to the darker dark beyond. Electrons finally freed into streams of gravity gone wild. While alone in the dust of Palestine, sad Luria watches as God withdraws, and so the world arises. Let the river horses run. Let them run. If, as has been said, it is our very love of God that separates us from him, can't we say that the names we sketch on the churning atoms of this world's things, while keeping us apart, allow us also to love? Isn't this enough? The shadow that we know a swallow by. The tide flows in, the moon spill. Let's hem down the river, witness the resting away. If America drew us to a destiny of desire, it was the outfall of a single star stunned, our sweet metals and machines. So return, exile, and then return again. Want no more than water does, low places to dwell and the gravity to change. And if you too are lost one day in loss itself, may you trace a bird amid the mess of stars. May you name it as you wish, seven-star bird, lover, God. And may its wandering guide your own. Let the river horses run. Let them run. Let them run wild as they ever would. The poem is really long. Oh, thanks. Thank you. So that closed that book, and in a way it was beginning to sort of open the door to the poems of this next book. When I talk about this book and the new book, it sounds as if I know what I'm doing or knew what I was doing. I don't. But this is the story that it seems to sort of come around it. That book is really about family and is about making connections and sort of trying to find a sense of home. And it deals a great deal with the past, sort of as past. The newer poems in this new collection, I sort of think of as being not exactly forward-looking, but extremely present. And so the challenge for me has been, and the goal was really to try to capture something of what it's like to. I wanted to capture something of a mind sort of moving across the planet with all the stuff sort of hitting it. And Gerard Manley Hopkins is one of my favorite poets, and a lot of people find him very difficult, and he can be challenging in certain ways. But there's something, what I feel he's done. One of the keys to him, from my point of view, is that he seems to, in the density of, you know, I caught this morning, morning's minion, kingdom of daylight's dolphin, dappled dawn, drawn falcon in his riding, and all that stuff. This incredible dense language is that I feel like he was capturing something of what it's like to have an experience for real. You know, that is, you know, that we can't have that anything that happens to us is. There are a billion things pressing on us. There's our past, every moment of your life, every little noise that's around you, even your projections into the future are all crushing down on this experience in a way that we can't possibly sort out at the moment that it's happening. So it's an incredibly dense thing that we begin to sort of tell stories about as we sort of find some sort of meaning in it. And I think what Hopkins has done is to try to just put you in that position and let that all those pressures come into you, all of those things are sort of vibrating, so that you get a feeling more like what it is, I think, to be alive, truly. without sort of telling a story that sort of keeps most of the stuff at bay, that filters it out. And so in my own, you know, little way, I think what I'm trying to do with these poems is to capture something of all of the noise that's sort of pressing in on us, of all the various lives that we've led that are a part of us at every moment. And including my vast and very dear friends who are long dead, like William Blake and John Keats, Heraclitus, people who have a huge impact on my life, who are very much alive to me and who I feel like I chat with constantly. And so I sort of bring them in. But the problem with that is that we have verbs and things which are tied to time, and you know, it's hard to make sense of it. So the challenge has been to sort of figure out a way, if I could, to make some kind of sense out of what really is nonsense by our standard way of thinking. And the other thing about these is, for the most part, I hope that they're more fun than the poems. Maybe not. So I read the first one. These, as might be sort of obvious from what I just said, there's a lot, you know, there. If we have 1,000 lives and we have a lot of these things pushing on us, it's very difficult to get at any notion of what might be factual, what might be true in any sort of literal sense. And so what I've done throughout these poems is a lot of things that sound like facts are total lies. And I've sort of mixed up how they're presented. And so, as you'll see very quickly in this poem, there's something that just you'll know right away is a lie. Maybe that's enough. Pythagoras is mentioned here. Pythagoras, one of my people. One of his major contributions that I haven't quite got right in this poem yet, but he's the guy who discovered that if you take a piece of metal and hit it with a hammer, it makes a certain pitch. If you take that piece of metal and cut it in half, it makes another pitch. And so it turns out that, you know, harmony is based on these fractional relationships that are absolute. Nobody had ever thought of this before. And the whole notion of harmony, as we get it, sort of comes out of that. Did that make sense, what I just said? Okay. What that means is, for the first time ever, there was a way of sort of concretely attaching a notion like, what is beautiful? What sounds good to us? You know, we think of abstracts like, what's beauty? What's truth? What's love? They're all so vague notions that we're all just sort of wrestling to sort of, you know, hold for a second. But for once in history, here was a time when we could say, oh, here's harmony. It's this metal slab being hit at the same time that this metal slab of a precise fractional relation is. So you had this kind of notion of something concrete, abstract, becoming concrete and understandable. So then we feel these vibrations in us that move us, that are just sort of these, all it's doing, you know, is just sort of resonating in various parts of your body and causing things to vibrate in these precise fashions. Anyway, and it feels good. All that is a very small part of the poem. Anyway, this is the sonnet. This is, I don't know, Laurie, do you assign sonnets? Okay, so for those of you who have wrestled with the sonnet, here's a sonnet that is not a poem called the sonnet that's not a sonnet. God, I love sonnets. I think of them every day, just as I think of my father, who was, in fact, a sonneteer. He wandered 12th century France or Italy. See, that's the lie, right? He wandered 12th century France or Italy, wherever, grief fog, such things, his huge head full of song. God, I miss him. But he clearly wasn't meant for war. They say he stood up in the trenches to recite poems in the enemy's direction. Love, you know, love. Then the red laser sight light found his forehead, reminding his commander for a moment of a beautiful Indian woman he wished to love. Bang, bang. Sometimes love is like that. Just as you reach for it, it runs away, or else it puts a bullet in your head. This may, of course, be the wrong kind of love. Sonnets are as mathematical as music, as elegant and sensible as the universe. And God, I love music. It was, I think, Pythagoras who, in the birthplace of democracy, sort of, hearing the harmonies of a blacksmith's hammer, determined that pleasurable resonance grew from metal slabs bearing precise fractional relations, and thus, for the first and only time, discovered a physical truth of an abstract notion. Despite many attempts, despite even the mighty sonnet, love remains adrift. Anyhow, sonnets, like the universe, are ruled by just six numbers, metaphors, really. Galaxies spin according to them, neutrinos blink and whirl, matter collapses. They suckle us in some stellar nursery, deliver gravity to break our hearts. Hearts filled with love, love and blood, the better kind of love. I know it would have been clever if this had been a sonnet, a double sonnet or some such. Yes, well, I'll leave that to my sons, who miss me already. They're very busy mapping out our future in the glowing digital domain. There will be conquests and certainty, end stops, and appropriate formal turns. And it won't be long now. They have the tools. They have the proofs. This book was begun really at the beginning of the very... The beginning horrors of the war, and it shows up in a lot of the images you'll probably see. And this one in particular, I grew up in the 60s. I mean, as a kid, as a very young kid in the 60s, and this poem takes place in Louisiana, and Vietnam was all around me. It was mostly like watching the Today Show was like a game where you'd see the dead and wounded every morning. You know, and as a kid, you don't know what it means. It was sort of horrible. But my next-door neighbor went off to war, and the older brother of a friend and died. And so it sort of suddenly came home. But that has a little bearing. So this is taking place there, The Naturalist. In nature, what is beautiful is often poisonous. And if it's beautiful and easy to catch, it's likely deadly. We watch a lot of nature shows. This fact supported by naturalists worldwide. Prophets are sometimes beautiful and, since often blind, are easy to catch. Their futures are always deadly. With poetry, however, even beautiful poetry, people tend not to get hurt. But I, beheaded by poetry, must drink the poison of the moon. It will spill out my throat. Scatter in the weightlessness we learned from 60s TV. Everything floated then. Men, wars, food, gods, even nature itself. Remember? This from an old myth about an eclipse, Hindu or Buddhist. It's about desire or immortality, maybe both. Who knows? Lately, I've spent more time in nature, whatever that means, often wearing space-age textiles. Whatever that means. And sometimes all nature is stainless steel, whole forests impervious to storm. When the wind blows there, it sounds like when you wet your knife. Other times, all nature is made of flesh. When the wind blows then, it sounds like when you wet your knife against my throat. Anyhow, years ago, deep in Louisiana's nature, I dove to catch a salt and pepper kingsnake as it slid into the earth, and I pulled it up. Then it bit me over and over until I could calm it and pin its head to the ground. It said, as all prophets do, "You, my love, are easy to catch. Write something, and remember how scared you are right now and always. Now let me go." The snake leaped to its hole and poured in. I actually did catch one. Actually, it was my friend Larry Higginbotham who actually pulled it out of the ground. I was too scared. We doing all right, so? Any thoughts? Questions? So I've already mentioned Milton and Blake as being people, I think, that they're really crucial to me. Maybe Milton is my favorite poet. It's hard to say. He's certainly someone who's changed me more than anybody else. And he's the least likely suspect of people, you know. It's like nobody invites you less into their world. But once you're there, it's astonishing, astonishing. In the 18th and 19th century, maybe, Leonard, you were touching, maybe this is touched on core, there was a lot of debate in aesthetic theory and the nature of beauty, and there were three sort of classes. So there was the picturesque and the beautiful, and then the sublime, with the three strata. The sublime was that which was godlike and would sort of obliterate you in its awe. The beautiful was just sort of the ordinary classical notions of beauty. And the picturesque was all the stuff, and this was a new concept at the time, was when you'd go out and see some barn that was falling down in England and say, oh, isn't that pretty? And this became the picturesque. And in those days, something in the sort of upper classes that I'm constantly mocking, they would wander around the wilderness, so-called, because there's no such thing in England, but they would wander around with these things called clawed glasses. And clawed glasses were these most often they were pink. They were pink lenses that would sort of frame nature. So you'd walk around with these glasses, and it would be framing all these sort of quaint country scenes. And it was this I think, sort of wonderful thing. Allen Ginsberg, I hope you know. If you don't, Allen's a big guiding light for me. And Kurt Cobain, maybe you know from Nirvana, shows up in this poem. And Keats, we all know Keats, right? Milton. See, I bring all my pals into this one. This poem is called Crash. It's very long, and I'm sorry. Are we doing okay time-wise? Crash. As a boy, angels appeared at my window. They would open it like a window to my parents dying, the jangling car crash, the spinning, that moment frozen, then the next. Such terror and beauty mixed, the angels' hilarity, they crept up the glass like frost. When I asked questions, the angels lied, or else they'd fidget like parents talking of sex. Or they'd open the window farther, revealing more pain, more spectacle, whole worlds churning in war, in fire, hysterical. It was dizzying. Or else they'd just vanish like fireworks, worms of light in my head, leaving the darkness I knew, fields bristled and shagged, the Negro church beyond glowing as it did above the frog pond silent with the cold. This is a fact, or was a fact. I live between Blake and Milton Streets in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I couldn't believe it when I figured this out, right? This is a fact. I live between Blake and Milton Streets in Cambridge, Massachusetts, amid, no doubt, a confusion of ecto activity. Both streets lead nowhere, or rather lead to other streets, their imperturbable houses hunched like mourners taking a handful of earth from a sextant's shovel. It's laughable. there we go. Hello? It's laughable, a joke, really. The houses' wings tucked close to their sides, the night sirens, the snapping at insects that whirl like planets around the lamppost suns. At 13, talking with my girlfriend on a beige princess phone stretched to my bed, I put a Ruger 22 revolver to my temple and did not pull the trigger, then or ever. Blake says, "It's funny, isn't it? Seeing through that hole and not with it." I say to him, and it's a kind of joke, "These are Milton's eyes." With all eyes closed, I see the red worms always. They turn into faces, Blake's, Milton's, everyone's I've known. There is madness in this method. Many questions plaguing the late 18th and early 19th centuries have, in our century, found answers in rural Tennessee. The picturesque, a Negro church perched in the red light of a sunlight above a frog pond with a field slightly fogged. The beautiful, my motorcycle ripping through that field as a car filled with parents spins off the road into the church and all into flame. The sublime, the church's wings spread. It rockets into the night. Its windows fill with the faces of the dead mouthing all our names. At 20, I fell in love with a dying woman, or else her dying, I don't know. Nothing had ever been so sad, so vivid, holding her as she threw up beside a car on Green Hills Avenue, or else making love and then stumbling to Mass. Her name was Laura, the Dawn. You know, a joke, it turns out. I begged her to marry me. I wanted what little she had left, wanted to hold it, to eat it, to stuff it down my throat. The angels still torment me for this. They shut the sky around me and say, "Nice work, Keats." I beg them. I was just a child, I say. I thought I loved her. She is an angel now. Earth, whatever. A little sun in my head, in many heads, rising. In Paris, near the end, her spleen hard as a melon, we made love like it was the last time. Which, and this is funny, it was. Then, drunk and driving through the madness of Paris, I crashed into a parked car, a carnival of sparks. And it was hilarious. We just kept going. Nowhere, it turns out. Blake gave me a souvenir of Claude glasses, a rose-colored mirror for framing our world that once belonged to Ginsberg and briefly to Wolfe, Lennon, Cobain, and various others, etc. With them, I wander the fields of houses blossoming across America in search of love or beauty, something. It's hysterical and pointless, of course. And so Milton gave me Blake's skull, which I wear over my own, as Milton did, and God. It's hilarious what you see, a beautiful joke, sublime even. At 9, my son, lovesick, considers death. At 9, obsessed with my parents' death, my parents brought me to a shrink in a green glass office building in Shreveport, Louisiana. He said, "What if they really did die in a car crash? What then?" "You mean," I said, "they really could die." 20 years later, another shrink, hearing this, bursts into laughter. Blake, too, and Milton, and all the angels, the whole world, laughing. 30 years later, my son stares, weeping, of course, at a screen of pixels that opens like a window to an evening long ago. That's a cheery one. Two more? Is that enough? Is that okay? Two more? Do I have time for two more? Now, the initial title of this was prior to that, and the original title of this book was "Crash and Other Assorted Love Songs," which is this poem, and it's a riff on "Layla and Other Assorted Love Songs" for old people there who know the Derek and the Dominoes record. It's a classic because there's a lot of rock and roll in this book, and. So I just love the title, I'm happy with it, and then the damn movie comes out. And so one of my dear friends said to me, "So from now on, just call it, you know, call it Crash, not the major motion picture." No, you know, I guess I think whatever Doc at the time was watching, it's just to me the notion of these screens. They're just these infinite screens that we're looking at that become the window, you know, into a world which is so, you know, at that age he was sort of obsessed, you know, with computers as a kid, and it was just strange to sort of see someone sort of entering a world the way that I spent my childhood staring at my window, wishing I didn't live where I lived, and he's looking sort of drifting off into his own place. This poem takes place in Charlottesville, Virginia, which is an interesting place for a lot of reasons. The Monticello is there, the home of Thomas Jefferson, a somewhat controversial but wonderful figure. it's a place where it's very difficult to live and not be very conscious of race and class issues, because it is a primarily white town surrounded by lots of poverty, and there are the universities there, and then of course the history of slavery that's there. This book really, there's a bunch of references, very ironic usages of words like Negro and lots of things like that are here. But there's some stuff to know too. The Replacements, the other greatest band of all time besides X, if you don't know them, Paul Westerberg was their lead singer. They had one song called Skyway that a lot of people know the words to, and singer-songwriter types will sing that song. It's a very sweet, lovey-dovey thing. And there's a mention here of another one of their somewhat famous songs, because none of them are famous, called A Little Mascara. And the refrain is, all you're losing is a little mascara, because she's heartbreak. This is based in a time when Allen Ginsberg was traveling around the country, sort of towards the end of his life, he was doing a series of lectures, asking people to forgive Ezra Pound his anti-Semitism. It was a very moving thing from a Jew, he really devoted himself for a long time of trying to preach that it was good to forgive Pound for his error. And Alan shows up here. I got to spend some time with him, and he makes an appearance. I think that'll do. It's called All You're Losing. It's Easter Eve in tracks and hot as hell in 1986 Charlottesville, and Paul Westerberg of the Replacements has forgotten the words to Skyway, the only song everyone else knows the words to. And as everything... he's a mess, man. And as everything hurdy-gurdies to a kind of halt, some other drunk yells, a little mascara, and Bob Stinson, flat on his back, cranks the A and E from his Firebird, and somehow the whole machine takes off, and before you know it, Westerberg's wailing, all you're losing is a little mascara. And it's true, love is like that. And my friend Elizabeth is peeling off her shirt, and so's Ginsberg, and all of us are skunk-drunk, bug-eyed gods, and the night's looking pretty good all around. Alan's been asking the world to forgive Pound for hating the Jews, and everyone in the lecture hall in this town we call Whitey seems more than happy to forgive. Usura, usura, okay, USA. At dinner, Alan told us to screw poetry altogether and to get into computers. The future, he said, live with it. I swear to God, he said that, except in a more vulgar way. The future, he said, live with it. Right as always, the beautiful bastard, that man among angels. But I wanted to pee on his feet. We all did, or kiss them. I don't know. Forgive us our past, that drunken bafflement. But now, Jesus, now... Just remembered, it's Easter in Charlottesville. There's a big Easter ceremony in Monticello. That's where we're headed. But now, Jesus, now, today, it's perfect, and we all understand. The show's done, and 10 years later, everyone will sound like Westerberg, and Cobain and friends will die for it, just like Bird died for it, and everyone else, for Christ's sake. Great and bitter rock and roll before and after, and we'll get tweaked in the back of a restaurant where everyone worked, where someone will snort a smiley face off the bar, and we'll drive out to Monticello, for God's sake, for the sunrise service, because we're sentimental by now, and because Alan was dying soon, and so was Bob, and all of us, and because Jefferson loved his slaves after all, and they'd be there in the midst of that hill, the midst of this beautiful country that tries to forgive everyone, every last one of us. And we're all climbing the hill, slumped like somebody's lashed to our backs, all of us, Alan, Paul, Elizabeth, me, everyone. The sun's coming up, and I'm holding Elizabeth, and so's Paul. And we're all crying by now, singing hymns like everybody else. The rocker Jesus, the Jew Jesus, every black Jesus in the ground, sweet Jesus of the painted eyes, the pale light spilling down the hill Jesus, the one nation conceived in Tom Jefferson's stables and brought forth in the pixelated fire of technologic wonder Jesus, shattered, automatized, the future, the past, all you're losing. were crying by now, singing hymns like everyone else, crying on a great American hill, because you just don't lose that much when you do. Ginsburg, he made us so mad. Yeah. No doubt about that. So I'll stop the poems, and then we have questions after this next one, okay? This is called Ornaments. It is now the title poem of this book, which is coming out from 12. Yes, it's coming out next year after next, whatever. And it's called Ornaments. Bring down your ornaments. Bring down the attic dust. Bring down the leaves, the husks of insects, the grease from windows. Bring down the clothes. Shovel them. Shovel them over the bodies you long ago brought down. Bring down the silver, the screaming, the cries of love. Bring them down and beat them. Bring them down to the street. Take a broom and beat them. Let the dust live in the sun shaft. Bring down their tiny planets. Beat them. Free them. Those bodies. You wanted them once. You asked for them. Now bring them down. Bring down everything you've ever wanted, shattered or soiled. Some flag, some country you loved once, some child you lost. Bring them down and beat them. Down to your streets and beat them. There is peace in it. There is peace in the beating. And bring down the poems you wrote, those strong feelings, the voice you had, so sweet, that beauty too, its lies, those centuries collapsed, of stoop, of musky stone. There was such promise then, such future. Bring them down to your streets, take out a broom, and beat them. The dust will catch fire in the sun shaft. It will light that light. It will burn it. Bring down those angels of glass, that hell, those whispers in your ear. They say, bring down the shame they died in, the suicide's longing, the bloody sheet, the first hard penis, then the mother's skittish love, the hazel of her eyes. Bring them all down. Bring them down to your streets and beat them. Bring down your fathers, too. Bring down how they drank and drank, how they beat you with their drinking and the wars they took you to, how you sat there cheering so long ago, centuries now. Now you must take them out to the street, drive them like mules to the street, and beat them, so you can take down the house itself, sweep off its skin, its muscle, to get to its galleried bone, to its teeth. Then tie a string to the doorknob, slam shut the door, and bring them all down. Pull out the floor, the windows, the walls, the twisted nails, the light that held them all. Then finally the door. Bring them all down into your streets. Take out your broom and beat them. There is peace there. When the dust rises in the light of the sun, it will come alive. It will take your shape, sparkling, adorned. It will rise over the streets now filled with you, over the villages, the cities now filled with you. Its eyes are your eyes, and it follows you in wonder. It will bless you. It will look you in the eye and bless you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, as a boy, it was extremely painful. My grandmother, you know, the way they do this, they come in and they try to buy everybody out, right? The state does, and the longer you wait to sell your property, the lower the price goes. My grandmother, who is an incredible rebel and had been sort of a fighter for various oppressed groups, and she just would take nothing from these people and refused to go. In effect, the result of that was that the being the last people to hold out, their property was valueless. And so when they moved, they didn't have much. You know, they had this 200-acre farm and was reasonably successful and all that. And it had dwindled to nothing. In the meantime, my grandmother had developed cancer. And my mother always assumed that that was because of what she'd done in that fight. So, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of anger about that. But on the other hand, you know, as time has gone along, it certainly doesn't feel like that. It seems... an early lesson in the illusion of holding on to things, of thinking that you can keep something forever. Sorry. And having to be able to let it go. So it's a crucial thing that shaped me, I think, very early. I won't cry, I promise.
If I may use the microphone, because they want it as part of the podcast recording, so I'll ask you to use the microphone, if you would.
Was it in Seven Star Bird where you mentioned snake being pulled out of a hole?
No, it's in the new book.
It's in the new book, okay. Well, my question was, you said that actually happened and it was an actual experience you had. And when you're writing these poems, how much of the material do you get from your own experiences? And how much are you getting from other influences you've had? Because you referenced so many other influences in your life. It was a little confusing to see like what might have been experiences you've had and what might have been other people's or what you thought of. Your influences or something. So how much is your own and how much is not?
I mean, it's a great question, and it's certainly right at the heart of what I'm doing with this book is, the larger question for me is what's the difference between something you experienced in a book or a poem or a movie or a piece of music, that was someone else's and what you actually factually seem to have experienced. Or another way to think of that is there a fact that you can point to in your life that you can say with absolute certainty is true? The classic is Oedipus, who thought that he had parents that were right beside him, and it turned out that it wasn't them, despite all the evidence. And I think there's that. But the practical question is that almost everything in these poems comes directly from my life. Ridiculous, exaggerations and juxtapositions, the things of the poems, the encounters that are in the poems, all happen. And as far as I know, or I've fantasized about them to the point where I can't tell if they actually happened or not. My brother and I, we are both the heroes of all of our childhood stories. It's like it just depends on who you listen to telling it, and I'm absolutely sure that I'm right, and he's absolutely sure that he's right, but we're both not right. But in any case, as far as I know, most of these events are certainly based in reality, and what I began to do is to sort of piece them together. Allen Ginsberg did come there. I had that conversation with him. He told me not to go. He told me and a couple of others that poetry was for losers and it was time to go out and make money, look into computers. It was 1986. If I'd done that, I'd be a rich man right now. And that's what makes me, that's talk about anger. I'm really angry about that. Because I just thought he was this old fart telling me that, I couldn't, we're arrogant graduate students. We're like, what are you saying? It happened. And the Replacements and Paul Westerberg were there. I went to a sunrise service with some of those people. But of course, there weren't dead people rising out of graves. but they, but, they, but, and, another way they also were. Because if you've been in that a situation like that, that is so, it's just such a rich experience that one feels a tremendous amount of stuff. So what's happened in this book is I stopped worrying about which things were real in the sense that we normally think of as being literally true, and what the associations and the things, the feelings that I had, giving them sort of the equal, you know, an equal amount of truth, which I know may be a ridiculous exercise. These may be terrible poems. I don't know. You know, maybe they're just too confusing. I really don't. But it's what I want to do right now, you know, to try to mix these things up. Because that's my experience. I really don't. The difference between what I've learned in books and what I've experienced in life is nominal. It's not, you know, it's, I mean, there are plenty of, I know John Keats better than I know a lot of my very close friends, you know, and he certainly had a bigger influence on me than most of those bums.
Another question.
Hi. I know Hi. When I'm writing poetry, it's always a struggle to translate what you're feeling into words. So I wonder if you could say, like, what that process is similar to for you?
God, that is such a beautiful question. Man. I've spent you know, my whole life around beautiful stuff, or what I think of as being beautiful stuff, around poems, and I know so many poems, not because I've sat down and learned them and this and that, it's just over years of being a teacher and somebody loved it, it's just accumulated in my head, you know. So those noises are just a huge part of my, I mean, again, it's really, so I steal so much stuff from people. I don't know anymore what's there, what was real and what's not, what's theirs and what's mine. But I know that there's something that comes in from those voices, from these people, whether they're musicians or artists or poets, that they're inside. And so my feelings, the feelings that I have are tied to that somehow. And it's as if, you know, something about having all this language in my head to me it's like a noise. There's something that opens up, and it feels like it's almost like a melody of all those different voices that seem to be attached to something I'm feeling that I just give over to. Do you know? I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's like some. It feels like. And this is not a mystical thing, but there's a sense of just being free to let what's already in me out, and hope that it's beautiful in some way. And I'm really questioning, you know, what I mean. These newer poems, I mean, these are not beautiful at all in the ways that I used to think beauty was, you know. And that's changed because I think more stuff has come in and sort of, you know, started. Solidifying with other things in my head, and different ideas have come together so that that's changed. And that's what, to me, a lot of this stuff is a challenge. It's like I want to be able to write a poem that includes everything. I mean, that will take every little aspect of the life, not the poetic things, you know, not the things that are sort of pretty by definition. That's what the first book focused a whole lot on, but rather to look around and to see how these things that I actually experience, not just the sort of the Keatses and the, you know, the Shelleys and that kind of beauty, but how that might be intermingled with the beauty that I see around me, you know, in car crashes, in whatever it may be. Is that kind of an answer? It's such a tricky thing, you know.
Another question.
Hey, we live in kind of an interesting time when now there's computers and it's different new medium for writing. What is your, like when I'm writing, I have this kind of debate, like, do I write in a notebook where it's a lot harder to like change stuff and edit, but it's more permanent, or computer where you can, it even spell checks for you and you can cut and paste and stuff. What is your, how do you relate to those different mediums, and what's your process? Do you like write in paper first and then go to the computer, or do you start with the computer or what?
Usually it's a paper draft, and but that's, I mean, it's another great question, because I think that the medium you choose has an impact, and not a negative or a positive impact, just an impact. It shapes what you do. My experience is I started writing a series of prose poems that really freed me from a certain type of writing. I used to be one of those people that really did, you know, I needed to be in some garret with the candle and the quill and the whole thing to sort of conjure this mood of being a poet, and needed absolute quiet and would sit, you know, and it a very precious sort of sense of that. And of course, I was writing these ridiculous, precious, silly little poems. And I was just, I think I just got sick of myself. And I had an old Smith Corona typewriter that really was like riding a lawnmower. You know, you turn it on, I'm a terrible typist, so I'm constantly making mistakes. And I started writing poems on it, and they were the most freeing and most wonderful things I ever wrote, and it changed my life. You know, so it was just that sort of going from one to the other. And now, this book primarily has been written on very heavy stock cotton paper with a 1 millimeter gel pen that bleeds a whole lot. And so so it's like a canvas that I'm painting on. I want them to go very fast. It's the opposite of being precious. I have done a little bit of composition on the computer with this book too, because I like that speed that I do have there. I don't know. I did, you know, a lot of that other book, a lot of it was written in pencil, which I think had a different, you know, had a different effect. So it's a great thing, and I think just to experiment. And I found that with my students, I really encourage them, if they're accustomed to doing something and they're having trouble writing, to just try another method, you know, for a while, to go off and to find a typewriter. Lots of my friends go out and look for the old manual typewriters that you can get for nothing in a junk store and work with those, just because it's a different tactile experience, and it makes a lot of weird noises, and just sort of disorients you from the expected. So I just think it's all tools. The thing I have with a computer is I can't keep track of my versions. So I revise a lot on computer, but I have like 10,000 versions, and I can never. It's the most confusing thing in the universe to me. I have coming here. I have no idea. None of these are the right versions of the poems, because I don't know which one is the right version. It seems like it's going to be clear to me at the time, and then, you know.
Question.
Well, my question plays on what you just said. How much of a purist are you? When I write, sometimes it just pours onto the page, and then I go back and ruin it, basically. Do you ever just leave it alone? Do you ever just write something and leave it alone? Or is that just not allowed?
Well, there are things I don't like to say in front of students. the last poem that I wrote was written in about 45 minutes, virtually unchanged, and it's one of my best poems from my point of view. I fiddled with it, but... you know, I don't like to say that. Sometimes there is this wave that comes in that you catch like a surfer, and you just take it and it goes. But if you wait for that to happen, you won't write a lot of poems. Trust me. Okay. So the combination is. I mean, I feel like ideally that you're constantly working at this, because when that wave comes, you want to be ready. You know, and I think the difference between me now as opposed to a young poet, when it happens, and there are special moments, and they're not going to happen too many times in your life, you better be ready. You better have the chops. And you'll only have the chops if you're working and reading. And I think that's what a lot of people don't realize. These things come, and it's not going to, you will not be able to get it on the page if you haven't done that work. And I think that work is a combination of reading and writing and keeping your head in it. But the whole muse notion, as much as I believe in it, is deadly. I mean, I'm someone who can go months without writing a poem because I'm just too damn lazy. It's one of the deep regrets of my life. So I strongly, you know. And on the other hand, you know, there is this beautiful thing of like when it comes, it's extraordinary.
time for another question or two. Is there another? Yes.
I'm not sure whether this is as much a question as just...
Ravings of a lunatic?
Yeah.
I'm related to this person.
Okay. I'm taken with how much documentation there is in what you write. You talk about, in part, I guess I want to say, do you write from, how many lenses are you writing from? Because you talk about the experience of immigrants in so many places, whether it's in Seven Star Bird, from the experience and lens of the Czechoslovakians or the boy, or in what happened and the relationship there. But then you talk about sweeping the streets and bringing everything to the streets, which is another immigrant experience much later on. And there's so much historiography in your work, as much as there is passion and experience. And I'm curious about that. I don't know exactly what question to ask about it, but I'm impressed with how much substance and fact you bring to also the personal experience of what you talk about.
Thanks, Chrissy. What lurks back there, I think, is this I just sort of have a faith that the things that move me, that I read or know, historical facts, information, I love to gobble up stuff, you know, just little bits and pieces. I trust that they fit into the fabric of my life, you know, and so that I'm a magpie. My notebooks are mostly, and that's why I was saying I steal everything, because I just jot down stuff, and I trust that it fits, that it's catching my eye for a reason, that it's a part of who I am. And so I just have a certain faith that I will be able to, that it will eventually fold into something that is part of my personal story. So this, you know, and this is what I hope in the book is it's certainly based on my experiences, but it's really about the construction of a self, not me, but the construction of, you know, how does one piece oneself together, whatever that means, and that this is this. So I have this sort of spirit, the spirit eye that's wandering over this thing, that's just gobbling stuff up, you know, and trying out of the stuff that it gobbles to build a body, and having trust that your taste, that everything works, because otherwise you wouldn't have seen it, you wouldn't have known it. So it really is just, you know, and it's a faith that every single aspect of your, you know, one's experience is significant. You know, and that's why it's not that everything is poetic or, you know, whatever that means, you know, that everything must be because it is our life. And what is art if it is not our life? You know, what value is it? So, you know, it's a kind of faith, that there's a sense, you know, that the imagination... Yeah, I just sort of take it as the world is just pure chaos, and that horrible things happen all the time for no good reason. But there must be something that sort of brings it together. That there's something I don't know anything else other than to say it's a way of shaping something out of chaos. And believing that whatever it is that I can shape, that the power of the imagination to do these things is the creative force, you know, a way of thinking the creative force of the universe. That it's something that's just that you can do it. You can think it. You can build these pieces together. They seem disparate. They occurred in different centuries, but they didn't really. Because what does it mean for something to have occurred a long time ago to us? It doesn't mean anything. It's now. It's the remember. It's presence in the moment that matters, And so it's kind of having faith that that's true, and that all of life is can be connected that way. Does that, I don't know if that's kind of, it's a weird thing.
Wonderful statement that I want to end on it, and say thank you to you, David, for coming here, for sharing so much with students this afternoon in classes, with us over dinner, but especially right now, in this setting, that you have shared yourself as well as your words with us. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And for anyone interested, there are some books for sale out in the lobby.